Hello, you're listening to the Soilify podcast, where we talk about regenerative agriculture and measuring soil carbon to meet modern day environmental challenges. I'm Kim Arora. In the last decade or so, global carbon markets, impact investing, and green bonds have expanded and diversified the kinds of funds that go into biodiversity conservation. According to an OECD report from 2020, 81 countries together spent an average of $67.8 billion per year domestically on conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity. The private sector piece of this pie was quite small according to the available data. To talk about what moves investment and funding in this sector, we have with us today Sheba Sen and Pradyot Porwal, who run Hasten Ventures, a firm that works on ecosystem restoration projects in India, the US, and Ethiopia. Welcome to the Soilify podcast, Sheba and Pradyot.
Hi, Kim.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking you, investment in the reforestation and biodiversity conservation has so far primarily been the preserve of philanthropy and CSR. Why is that?
Yeah, so Kim, I come from the nonprofit sector. So I have felt that pain for a long time, working with a restricted source of capital. And in my experience, I would condense it to mainly three reasons. One is ecosystem restoration as a product. It's a complicated product because there are lots of moving parts to it. It's the whole ecosystem. So it's a complicated product to begin with when you look at commercial investments, the kind of investments that are made in products and services. Two, there's a gestation period built into this. So, you know, the rate of return or what kind of, at what point you might start to make returns is much longer than what commercial capital engages with right now. Also, I would say that the risk factor, because there are, you know, as a product, it's complicated, i.e. so there are multiple stakeholders, multiple land tenures involved in that. If you're talking about a product, a project at a scale. So that's, there's a lot of risk involved there, which can, you know, inhibit investors to sort of participate in these projects. And then I think finally, because it's a complicated product, there is sort of, I think, a lot of scope for more innovative design, to bring in technologies, to bring in more innovative ways of engaging stakeholders, which is a lot of times lacking in projects right now, which further complicate the unattractiveness of other sources of capital to, you know, venture on these sorts of investments.
And you're right, there are certain projects in this sector that can only access philanthropic funding as of now. How can commercial capital add to these projects and the impact that they have?
Yeah, so the thing is, large-scale ecosystem restoration projects really need all kinds of capital to participate. So a role of CSR, philanthropic capital, is in these projects can be very catalytic. So say in the beginning, they can help kickstart these projects. Right now, that's the only capital that happens, and you do a set of activities for 3 to 5 years or even longer, and there's no sort of continued economic engines that can be brought into that ecosystem that are aligned with regeneration. So the way commercial capital can participate is that once these projects are kickstarted, the landscape starts to, you know, create assets that are sequestering carbon, providing the ecosystem services by investing in new supply chain development, you know, new business models that are coming out of the products that arise from this ecosystem, investing in more innovative technological you know, services or products that can be brought into these projects. Now, we mustn't forget, you know, when we look at, again, ecosystem restoration, these take us to rural parts of the world, you know. I mean, these are billions of customers with unmet needs. That it's a huge market, but it's just the way of how different capitals can unleash these projects and play their roles in a way that allows commercial capital to then participate at a certain point in the project to really you know, unleash the economic development that is needed as part of the restoration. Because restoration just done from a landscape perspective will never undo the inbuilt, you know, economic supply chains that will result in degradation again 20 years from now. So we need to have new circles built in and create opportunities for commercial capital, and projects will immensely benefit from that.
Of course, you have worked in different parts of the world. In India, you've worked in Uttarakhand, and you've also worked in Ethiopia and the US. What have you seen in this regard, in terms of what you said about unleashing the economic potential of these places while restoring the ecosystem? What have you seen in your experience in these places?
Yeah, so I would say that we can divide this the kind of projects into, say, a developed economy and a developing economy. So a lot of HACEN projects right now are in India, and, you know, we're starting in Ethiopia. So I take a developing country example here for this question. So say in Uttarakhand, I've spent about 10 years directly in Uttarakhand in my career so far. So a landscape restoration project there would, say, start with reforestation or protection of existing forests on common lands, on wastelands. But most of the times that activity is just that activity because of various reasons of project design, sources of funding that are not able to give opportunities to, say, invest in new sources of fuel production and fuel availability to the local customer. So in a way that they have no need whatsoever to go and, you know, deforest the new forest that we may plant to meet their fuel needs. What could be the investments made in Uttarakhand to have better water access? I mean, that's a huge, huge unmet need of, you know, millions of people. One thing you can say that the water in itself is, you know, we need to recharge the rivers, we need to recharge the springs, and that's what happens in a restoration part of the project. But once we have the water regenerated, there's a huge investment opportunity to get access to people of that water, drinking water.
The communities on the ground that you're working with, what are they saying? What, how do they feel about new kinds of funds coming in?
Listen, no one is going to say no to investment. I mean, I know so many people in rural parts of India, and we're talking about Uttarakhand. What are their needs, you know, articulated and unarticulated needs? I need sources of income that are short term and also give me medium to long term security. I need better alternatives to meet my basic needs of fuel, fodder, and water. And then you come to this, Uttarakhand has some, you know, one of the highest rates of unemployment in the country. You've got this untapped young people and youth potential there. They need new skilling. They need new kinds of jobs. They need.
So there's no skepticism as such with these things yet.
No, there is only skepticism if we go to them and say that we are going to increase the biodiversity here because we need more tigers and we need more leopards, and we are going to, you know, give you jobs to plant trees and raise saplings, and that's where it ends, because that is only a restoration landscape approach. It is not an economic development approach. When you look at economic development, catalytic funding comes from philanthropy and CSR, who are looking for social returns. Brilliant. Kickstart the project. And then the design of the project has to be made in a way that economic development is unleashed, say in Uttarakhand, in a way that's aligned with nature. I mean, there's a huge untapped fruit market there, herbs market there, ecotourism market there. It's just not able to attract the investment it needs right now.
And of course, this is a two-way street. So what kind of material returns are investors looking for then?
Yeah, so I think in terms of returns, obviously, there is an entire spectrum, right? So there are impact investors as well as commercial investors. And we can talk about the ranges, but in terms of return metrics, but that's not the important piece here. I mean, any person investing in projects like these at this time also associate a lot of value to the social and environmental factors the positive factors that can generate out of these projects. And with the emergence of the ESG as a key impact metric and term, a lot of organizations and funders are sort of re-strategizing their investment portfolios and also thinking about how to increase their allocation into more meaningful planet positive projects. And that's where we see clearly a tremendous opportunity to increase and direct and channel investments in the right way to the right projects and the right communities so that it can be maximized in terms of all the various impact metrics to be achieved. Now, in terms of returns, right now, the ecosystem hasn't evolved to the extent that we have clear benchmarks and standards emerge in terms of the whole measurement and monitoring framework. And that is still work under progress. A lot of developments have happened globally in the last 4 to 5 years in that respect, both in public as well as private markets. I think you alluded to some of those during your introduction. And like in the public markets, frameworks like SASB, SASB, which is the Sustainability Accounting and Standards Board, for public corporates, as well as within the private markets, there is Global Impact Investing Network that has published IRIS Plus guidelines to create some sort of standards for impact monitoring and measurement for all types of asset managers and asset owners. But a lot more work needs to happen for when this money is actually invested in the projects to come up with the right standardized measurement and monitoring mechanism, because a lot of impact also is not really quantifiable right now, right? So there are both qualitative as well as quantitative aspects to impact. And the way our economic system is built and structured right now, there are a lot of externalities, like questions like how do you measure biodiversity impact are seem relatively simple, but are still not quantifiable in a very meaningful way. The emergence of carbon offsets is a form of payments for ecosystem services that has come up, but a lot more work needs to happen in terms of creating biodiversity credits, water credits, and so on and so forth. And there are various organizations working globally to address these issues, but yeah, a lot more work needs to go into it so that the ecosystem, in terms of the financial infrastructure that is required to support this work in a meaningful way, comes together.
How do you think something like remote sensing can help you measure the impact of your investment?
Yeah, so it relates back to some of the quantification aspects that I mentioned in my previous response. So one key element within the impact monitoring and measurement process is quantifying various factors like carbon sequestration, biodiversity enhancement, any other positive environmental impact that gets generated through the projects in the form of improved soil quality, improved water table in the region. Depending on the technological limitations, as many parameters as we can track and quantify and measure over various periods of time to clearly show the positive benefits that a specific intervention has generated in the project region will tremendously help to sort of build the investor confidence and bring in more people into this, which is a key sort of gap that exists in the market right now and a key risk factor that exists in the market right now, which sort of prevents a lot of people to allocating substantial amounts of resources into these types of projects and activities.
Since we're talking of investments, I was really hoping seed funds would come up, which is so appropriate if we're talking about reforestation. We always love a good pun here at Soilify. But
just to add to that, I think we have seen some movements and developments happen in that, at least in the global markets already, right? So there are funds coming up dedicated to managing forests, and a lot of asset managers and insurance companies are actively looking to build their forest portfolios to sort of use those as a buffer and an offset against the emissions that some of their other portfolio holdings contribute towards. And as a lot of these MRV and monitoring and measurement related issues get solved through technological means, I think that's definitely going to be the logical next step.
Great. No, this has been a great discussion. Thank you so much, Sheba and Pradyut, for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Kim.
Pleasure, Kim. All the very best.
Thank you. That's all we have time for today on the Soilify podcast. You will find links to any news reports, articles, or studies we referred to in the podcast in the show notes. Until next time, goodbye.